Thank you, Dave. Turn to Hebrews chapter 12, if you're not already there. And while you're turning there, I'm going to say thank you all for coming. And I see we have some visitors in our audience. Thank you for also being here. If you have any questions about what we are doing today, what we have done so far, then please stick around and ask me or really anyone else why we do the things that we do, and we'll give you an answer there. And if you don't have any questions, please stick around anyway for us to greet you and to thank you for being here with us today. I'll admit the generic principle about talking about Mount Zion and going to Hebrews chapter 12, I did steal. Last weekend, Jill and I went to VBS over in Wichita, and they were talking about mountains. That was their theme for the week. And so the last night was Mount Zion. That was when we got to see. And so as I was sitting there listening, I started thinking up a lot of ideas for what I wanted to do for this lesson. But with Hebrew, once you're at Hebrews chapter 12, if you'll stick a finger there and turn back to Exodus 19. Exodus 19. Okay. I want to focus on this phrase here. You have come to Mount Zion that we read in Hebrews chapter 12. But to get the full understanding of what that means, but you have come to Mount Zion, we need to have a little bit of some background information. And so the first is, I was really glad I found this. I thought this was a really, really cool picture. I think that that's a really good artist representation of what I think we're about to read here. But if you'll notice here, we've got some tents down here at the bottom. We've got some people gathered around the base of the mountain here. And then there's this mountain engulfed in lightning and clouds and multicolored fire. And this is a very similar image to what we're going to be reading in Exodus chapters 19, 20, and 24. But this is an artist's depiction of Mount Sinai. And let's first look at Exodus chapter 19, verses 16 through 25. It came about on the third day when it was morning that there were thunder and lightning flashes and a thick cloud upon the mountain and a very loud trumpet sound, so that all the people who were in the camp trembled. And Moses brought the people out of the camp to meet God, and they stood at the foot of the mountain. Now Mount Sinai was all in smoke because the Lord descended upon it in fire, and its smoke ascended like the smoke of a furnace, and the whole mountain quaked violently. Then the sound of the trumpet grew louder and louder. Moses spoke, and God answered him with thunder. The Lord came down on Mount Sinai to the top of the mountain, and the Lord called Moses to the top of the mountain, and Moses went up. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, "Go down, warn the people, so that they do not break through to the Lord to gaze, and many of them perish. Also let the priests who come near to the Lord consecrate themselves, or else the Lord will break out against them." Moses said to the Lord, "The people cannot come up to Mount Sinai, for you warned us, saying, 'Set bounds about the mountain and consecrate it.'" Then the Lord said to him, "Go down and come up again, you and Aaron with you, but do not let the priests and the people break through to come up to the Lord, or he will break forth upon them." So Moses went down to the people and told them. So the very first thing we see here, this is God has brought the Israelites out of Egyptian bondage into the wilderness to Mount Sinai. And he tells them, "I am going to come down." He's already told Moses that he will come down. And so this is the first image that we really get. Of course, God has taken place in different passages before, but this is the first time we sort of see God coming down in all of his glory. And what I find very interesting about this is that it seems that the laws of physics are sort of breaking down here a little bit. It seems that the mountain is on fire, which, first of all, stone doesn't burn. So there's already a problem that we have there. But we also see that the mountain is shaking and quaking. Again, not very normal for what we see here. And how it's also both fire and light, but it's also darkness. And so there's this interesting collaboration between the two of light and dark swirling here. And then God is speaking out and his voice sounds like thunder itself. We get images that terrify the people. And they are not allowed to approach the mountain. And we're actually going to read when we go back to Hebrews 12 and what we would have read already prior to this here in Exodus 19, is that if anyone approached the mountain without God's approval, they were to be stoned, whether it be a person or an animal. And it says that they were either to be stoned or shot from afar so as not to touch the mountain. So God is not messing around here. You are not going to come to this mountain. But then we're going to read a little bit more about God's presence being here on Mount Sinai in chapter 20, beginning in verse 18. All the people perceived the thunder and the lightning flashes and the sound of the trumpet and the mountain smoking. And when the people saw it, they trembled and stood at a distance. Then they said to Moses, "Speak to us yourself and we will listen, but let not God speak to us or we will die." Moses said to the people, "Do not be afraid, for God has come in order to test you, in order that the fear of him may remain with you, so that you may not sin." So the people stood at a distance while Moses approached the thick cloud where God was. So not only have they seen this terrifying image, the terror isn't going away. And it's so bad that they're saying, "Look, God can speak whatever, it doesn't matter, but please, you tell us what God says instead of God speaking to us, because this is terrifying." And so the people plead with Moses to speak for them because of what they're seeing. And sadly, spoiler alert, over in chapter 32, their fear of the Lord does not stay. As far as we know, by chapter 32, the Lord is still on top of Mount Sinai, but then they make a golden calf. And that's all against what we're about to read here in 24, verses 9 through 11. So turn to Exodus chapter 24, verses 9 through 11. So now God is saying that Moses can bring more people up the mountain with him, but only very specific people. "Then Moses went up with Aaron, Nadab, and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel, and they saw the God of Israel." Do not let that escape your notice. "They saw the God of Israel, and under his feet there appeared to be a pavement of sapphire as clear as the sky itself. Yet he did not stretch out his hand against the nobles of the sons of Israel, and they saw God, and they ate and drank." So Moses, Aaron, Nadab, Abihu, I threw in Joshua. We know Joshua is there, even though he's not mentioned. And then these 70 elders, they get to see God. And God has always warned that you cannot see me and live. But God is giving them a moment here. I don't know how much of God they're actually seeing. We know that when Moses sees the, as God puts it, the back of God, his face shines to the point that he has to cover it with a veil because the people are terrified of it. I don't know how much of God they're actually seeing here. But it is enough of an image, and God has feet, apparently, in this image. They're seeing enough of God that it says they're seeing God himself. And under his feet, a pavement of sapphire. So something that's so wonderful is just something's laying at the feet of God. But notice that it's not just that they're seeing God. So they had this moment of terror, but now these nobles, as God calls them in verse 11, the nobles of the sons of Israel, they not only get to see God, they get to commune with him. They get to eat and drink with him in his presence. And, man, it's one of those moments I would love to have been there. I want to know what they're seeing. I want to know what it's like. Are they still shaking with terror? Because I probably would be. But then keep going down to verse 16, same chapter, 24, verse 16. The glory of the Lord rested on Mount Sinai, and the cloud covered it for 6 days. And on the seventh day, he called to Moses from the midst of the cloud. And to the eyes of the sons of Israel, the appearance of the glory of the Lord was like a consuming fire on the mountaintop. Moses entered the midst of the cloud as he went up to the mountain, and Moses was on the mountain 40 days and 40 nights. So here, the last moment that we see of God here is that he appears to be a consuming fire. And that phrase is going to be important over in Hebrews chapter 12. Okay? So just remember that. But this is what we see when God first comes to his people. Okay? He has, he's been a pillar of cloud and a pillar of fire for them, leading them. But that was apparently nothing compared to this that they're getting in full view. And again, after a month of seeing it, I guess they become desensitized to it, because by chapter 32, we're worshiping a golden calf. And by the way, the man who leads that charge of making the golden calf is one of the men that says he got to see God. So just remember that. We always want to talk about, well, if I could just see God, it's not enough for people. You have to have the fear of God. They were afraid of God. We saw that in these first two passages. They were afraid of God. They didn't have the fear of God. And I just want to compare these images, okay? So here's Mount Sinai. It's a spectacle. It's terrifying. There's fire and lightning and quaking. It's a different mountain altogether that we have come to. We've come to a mountain that is simple and yet powerful and stands forever. Hebrews chapter 12. We're going to start a little bit higher than verse 22. We're actually going to start back up in about verse 18. Hebrews chapter 12. Beginning in verse 18. For you have not come to a mountain that can be touched, and to a blazing fire, and to darkness and gloom and whirlwind, and to the blast of a trumpet, and the sound of words, which sound was such that those who heard begged that no further word be spoken to them. For they could not bear the command, if even a beast touches the mountain, it will be stoned. And so terrible was the sight that Moses said, I am full of fear and trembling. We're not told that Moses says that. This is the only time we ever see that. The only time we see that Moses is trembling on a mountain is when he sees the burning bush before he starts his journey with the Lord. But before we get into 22, because that's where we see, but you have come to Mount Zion, we already get an image of what Mount Zion is if we can compare it to verses 18 through 21. So what can we already tell about Mount Zion? Well, first, it cannot be touched. Now, this is more of a literal sense, right? Because proverbially, it's actually the opposite of Sinai. With Sinai, they could look at it, they They could touch it. It was tangible, but they weren't supposed to touch it. It's the reverse for us. It is an ethereal mountain. It is a proverbial mountain, but it can proverbially be touched. And it can be climbed by all who come to it. Secondly, Mount Zion is not terrifying. It's not meant to strike fear into my heart. It's meant to strike communion and faith into my heart. And lastly, we will not be stoned on approach. That will not be true of us. We have access to the mountain. So think back to what we just read, and now when he says, but you have come to Mount Zion, verse 22, that's a completely different image than what we just read in Exodus 19, 20, and 24. Let's keep going. Verse 22, but you have come to Mount Zion and to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, and to myriads of angels, to the general assembly and church of the firstborn who are enrolled in heaven, and to God, the judge of all, and to the spirits of the righteous made perfect, and to Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant, and to the sprinkled blood which speaks better than the blood of Abel. So first, it says, you have come to the city of the living God, heavenly Jerusalem. Okay, that's the first description that we're given here. So Mount Zion is less of a mountain and a city. And this is not new for those of us who have read our Bibles before. Mountains are often used in reference to kingdoms. Mountains have a lot of significance to particularly the Jews. Mount Zion is really the only mountain that has a lot of significance to us as Christians. But notice that it's a city of the living God, which we know in the New Testament, when cities are referenced, we're actually not talking about cities, are we? We're talking about people. So by coming to Mount Zion, you have come to God's people. But here's the thing, it's not just God's people, it's the living God's people. He is a living God. He's not an idea. He's not some ethereal, impersonal force out in the great unknown. He is a living God. He is a being that has life and personality. He's a personable being. And he has knowledge, wisdom, power. And we are his people. So that's our first discussion of Mount Zion. The second thing that he says, you have come to Mount Zion, is you've come to myriads of angels. That's the way the New American Standard reads, myriads of angels. There's a few different ways that I've seen translations take that on. But myriads of angels. So not only have you come to a group of God's people, you have come to God's servants as well. Those who God uses to do his bidding. They can be messengers. They can be harbingers of either doom or good news. God uses them for various heavenly and earthly purposes. And sometimes those purposes are directed at us. That God comes and helps us as well. And we see that throughout the Bible. In fact, in our Daniel class, we haven't gotten there yet, but we will get there, is a discussion of what goes on in the heavenly realm. And again, it's a vision, but we'll get to see some of that discussion as well in Daniel. And we see that also given to us in the New Testament as well. Now, you haven't just come to a group of God's people, but we're citizens. God's people are citizens of his kingdom. And notice that it's not about our enrollment here. It's about our enrollment in heaven. In a few places in the New Testament, there's this idea of the book of life. And that our names are either written in or struck out of the book of life. And so the enrollment is in heaven. It makes me think back to the book of Acts, where it says, "And the Lord added to his church those who were being saved." God knows those who are enrolled in heaven. And then he says to God. So notice, it was the city of the living God. That was the first thing. Now he says, "Oh, and by the way, you've come to God himself." Notice, what are we talking about? Mount Zion. We're talking about God's people. But when you have come to God's people, you've come to God himself. This is something that Jesus mentioned, did he not? "If you've seen me, you have seen the Father." And then he promised us that if we would follow his commandments, that we would be like him. And God lives in us. We are the living temple of the living God. And so when you come to God's people, then you come to God himself. And notice that he's not just called God, he's called the judge of all. It is by his word that all things happen. And he will judge. And then it says, "The spirits of the righteous made perfect," which in other places the New Testament calls them saints or the sanctified. And so notice here, he's already said the city of the living God, the general assembly and church of the firstborn who are enrolled in heaven, and then spirits of the righteous made perfect. Notice that God keeps referencing us in different ways. And notice I said us. We'll get to that in a minute. But he's talked about us in three different ways. We are a city of the living God. We are where the living God dwells. Then we are an assembly. We have been assembled by God. And our enrollment is in heaven, and the righteous made perfect. And then lastly, he says, "And to Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant." The new covenant has been given to us by Jesus, and to the sprinkled blood. And we'll talk about, notice he separates Jesus and the sprinkled blood. If you were paying attention, which speaks better than the blood of Abel. Okay, let's talk about what that means here. First off, Jesus, through his sprinkled blood, has brought about a new covenant. But why does he bring up the blood of Abel? Well, let's go back to the story of Cain and Abel. What did the blood of Abel say about Cain? It accused him. "You have shed my blood. In your hatred, you murdered me." Jesus' blood is not the same. It does not cry out against us, it cries out for us. Instead of us murdering Jesus, Jesus willingly spilled his own blood. And in so doing, instead of crying out against us, it is the thing that frees us. It is the thing in which makes all the rest of it possible. That we can be spirits of the righteous made perfect. That we can be the assembly and church enrolled in heaven. That we can be the city of the living God. It's all because of what Jesus did. But notice that that's not where the Hebrew writer stops, is it? Keep going with me into verse 25. Because now he's going to take this a bit further. "We have come to Mount Zion," So now what? See to it that you do not refuse him who is speaking. For if those did not escape when they refused him who warned them on earth, that would be God's prophets, much less will we escape who turn away from him who warns from heaven. That'd be Christ. And his voice shook the earth then, but now he has promised, saying, yet once more I will shake not only the earth, but also the heaven. This expression, yet once more, denotes the removing of those things which can be shaken, as of created things, so that those things which cannot be shaken may remain. Therefore, since we receive a kingdom which cannot be shaken, let us show gratitude by which we may offer to God an acceptable service with reverence and awe, for our God is a consuming fire. There's a few things that I want us to notice here. We already mentioned in verse 25, him who warned them on earth, which are God's prophets, versus him who warns from heaven, that would be Jesus. And then notice it says, his voice shook the earth then. When was that? Well, we just read it, didn't we? Back at Mount Sinai. It quaked the very ground they were standing on. But God has promised us something that cannot be shaken. It cannot quake with fear. Yet once more I will shake not only the earth, but also the heaven. Yet once more, I love this explanation that the Hebrew writer gives us. Yet once more denotes the removing of those things which can be shaken. God no longer looks through a lens looking at things that can be shaken. That's not where God's focus is. God is focused on a proverbial kingdom. God is focused on a heavenly kingdom. One that does not have to abide by the laws of this universe. And then it says, therefore, if you've never heard this before, you always look at the word therefore to see what it's there for, right? Things which cannot shaken may remain, and we have a kingdom which cannot be shaken. This mountain that God has brought forth for us, that we can climb to its summit. Notice, how do we climb to its summit? Let us show gratitude by which we may offer to God an acceptable service with reverence and awe. This is something that the Israelites never figured out. Gratitude, acceptable service with reverence and awe. Because again, after 40 days and 40 nights, what do? They make a golden calf and they start worshiping it. God is right there on top of the mountain in the middle of talking with Moses, trying to give them the law that they could follow. And they're busy at the base of the mountain building idols. That can't be us. We can't put up our own idols and expect that God will be happy with us. We're supposed to be on the mountain with him. I want you to note this last verse, verse 29. For our God is a consuming fire. Remember back in verse 23, it mentions to God the judge of all. God will bring his consuming fire down upon every one of us. But there's a difference. When I am consumed by the consuming fire of God, it's meant to melt away the imperfections. It consumes the part of me that doesn't belong. and is left with something pure, something that God can work with, something that God can mold to his own will. But I have been consumed in the process, and I'm okay with that. To everyone else, that consuming fire is utter destruction. There is nothing pure left for God to work with. You haven't left anything pure for God to smelt out. And I love verse 22. But you have come to Mount Zion. And I want you to think of it as you sitting in the audience this morning. This is what God is saying to you. You, this morning, have come to Mount Zion. There are those of us here who are enrolled in heaven. And we are on the mountain. But there are those here who are standing at the base of the mountain and looking up and wondering, how do I get to the top? If you turn to your proverbial right, instead of looking up at the top of the mountain, turn to your proverbial right and you'll notice a tram. You've seen those trams, right? Trams that will take you to the top of mountains. And then if you look down at the path between you and the tram, you'll notice words on the path in front of you. The word closest to you is the word here, which hopefully is what you've done this morning. You have heard the word spoken to you. You've heard what is promised to you. You can take part in this Mount Zion. But you can't just hear about it. You have to believe it. That's the next word in the path. And as you believe what God tells you, not just that he knows what he's talking about, but also believing in the things that he has promised you to be part of this mountain, this kingdom. Once you come to believe that, then there's another word right after it, which says repent. And that's where you leave all the supplies you brought with you to go hiking. You put your bag on the ground and you leave it there. And you'll notice there are a lot of packs that have been left there. You are not alone. There are those who have gone through this path before you. You have to leave the pack there and you have to walk away. And you have to trust that you'll make it to the top of the mountain without those supplies, because they'll only slow you down. The next word on the path, and it's right next to the tram, and it says confess. You've heard, you've believed, and you've repented. Now it's time for you to say out loud, for your benefit and for others, who Jesus is, what he's done for you, the role that he ought to play in your life, which is to be the consuming fire. And then you'll notice at the top of the tram, there's a word that says baptism. And once you have been baptized, that's taking a step onto the tram. And you'll notice right next to a tram, it says, tram rides free. It will cost you nothing in the grand scheme to board that tram and make it to the top of the mountain. And sadly, there is no other path to the top of the mountain. That is the only way. You get on that tram, and if you stay on that tram and don't get off anywhere else, you will make it to the summit. You will make it all the way there. I promise. And I can make that promise because God has already made that promise to us. God is not going to fail on his promises. And so I can promise you what he promises you. You will make it to the top. This morning, if you need some help in where to go from here, now is the time to ask. Now is the time to seek. Because there are people who never look to their right. They just march toward that mountain and they find out too late, you will never make it to the top. You can only make it by the way that God has provided. And so if you need help going the way that God has provided, then we will do everything in our power to help you. If you've realized that you've gotten off the tram somewhere, it's time to get back on. It might take some effort to get back to a place where you can get back on that tram, but you can make it. You can get back on it. And you can make your life right with him. Whatever your needs are this morning, now is the time to take care of them. Because once you leave, we have another service tonight. I don't know if God will give us the time to make it to the service tonight. Don't waste the chances that you have right now. Bring Christ your broken life is a song that we're about to sing. Whether it's coming to God for the first time or whether it's coming back to God, something is broken, and it's time to fix it. Fix it now while we stand and sing.
Bring Christ your broken life, so marred by sin. He will create anew, make whole again. Your empty, wasted years, he will restore. And your iniquities, remember no more. Bring him your every care, if great or small. Whatever troubles you, oh, bring it all. Bring him the haunting fears, the nameless dread. Thy heart he will relieve and lift up.